Hello and welcome to the Investors Chronicles Personal Finance Podcast. I'm Moira O'Neill and joining me in the studio today is my colleague Kate Bearley. We're also delighted to have two special guests on the show. Helal Mia is an investment research analyst at the Share Centre and Delith Richards is Head of Funds Research at Kleinwort Benson. In today's show, we're going to look at investing in Japan for income. We'll also discuss the benefits of investment trusts that were originally set up by wealthy families to manage their wealth. And plus, we have an update on how lots of income drawdown providers have been changing their fee structures. But first, to this week's portfolio clinic. Simon is 68 and he's retired and he thinks he's not going to need to draw fully on his self-invested personal pension. He is therefore investing for growth so that he can leave more to his children. And the portfolio is invested entirely in direct holdings in company shares. Now, Helal and Delith were the expert commentators on this portfolio. Helal, you thought that Simon's shares-only portfolio wasn't really properly balanced between sectors and companies. So how do you think he was going wrong?
I think while he does have some big blue chips from various parts of the world, I just think there's too much of a concentration, probably towards stocks that he's aware of and knows quite a bit about. But the issue here is I think these stocks are generally very industrial or technology focused, and two of his stocks are slightly on the large side. So he's got Unilever, which is a company we certainly like very much, but at 18% of the portfolio, almost 20, I think that's a bit too much. And then he's got 3M, the US industrial group. Again, 15% of the portfolio, I'd say slightly too much there. So ideally, for most of our clients, we generally recommend to actually consider having a maximum exposure to any one particular stock of about 10% as a rough idea. It's just for practical purposes. I mean, generally, we'd like to see the maximum weight of each individual stock slightly lower, but I think 10% or so is practical for most private investors.
Do you think maybe he hasn't rebalanced enough as he's gone along and then the stock's done well, or he said, I like that and I've bought a bit more and not really paid attention?
I think that could partly be the case, simply because it looks like he's a bit of a buy and hold investor, which there's nothing wrong with that. And I would say a lot of these investments, the engineering focused ones, have actually done relatively well over the years. So you consider we had the dot-com crash, probably didn't invest too much there. Then we've had the financial crisis. I know he's got a few banks in there, but he's not overly exposed. And more recently, we've had the oil and gas and now the commodities areas, which aren't doing too well. But his exposure isn't towards these in general. So I think he's done relatively well. He's bought and held on to them. But I think going forward, the portfolio isn't defensive enough for me. And the fact that he's looking to take some payments from the pension fund in about 6 or 7 years, I would say now is probably the time to start considering making the portfolio a bit more defensive. And there just aren't enough defensive sectors in here. And I think most of the stocks are actually very cyclical, apart from Unilever, and he's also got Reckitt Benckiser. But what I would say there is these are very similar companies. And these two put together, you're almost talking about 25% of the portfolio. Again, too much.
So, Delith, you made some good comments on this portfolio too. I mean, actually, the investor, Simon, said he wasn't very keen on investing in funds at all because he was worried about charging levels and duplicating charges. And I'm going to quote him. He said, "Perhaps this is vainglorious, but with so many funds to choose from, one might as well have a go oneself and invest directly where one can have some idea of what one is doing." I mean, that I'm sure a lot of our listeners might share that sentiment, but you felt that some value could be added through funds?
Absolutely. I think the greatest concern here is that Simon's portfolio is concentrated in 16 instruments, and albeit we can look at what the market cycles are doing, but there's very, very specific company-specific risk in a portfolio that is that small. And when one looks at an investment portfolio of generally this size, we would encourage a greater element of diversification. I mean, it's very easy to pick stock-specific crisis stories at the moment. We have Glencore, and we can look across other parts of the market which have suffered. But whilst appreciating there is a concern about costs and that by a direct equity selection in a portfolio, there may be a feeling that you're not having to pay an external manager, there are so many low-cost ways of compiling and composing portfolios these days. In the submission, I know that I referenced the Vanguard Global Equity Market low-cost passive, but there are other low-cost index funds. As recently as this week, Fidelity have launched even lower price index funds. So it is very easy to find very large diversification of risk with low-cost elements of passives. And especially when you think about lifestyle investment here, as he's moving towards needing that capital payment, I echo the point he should be looking to perhaps take away some of the risk in his current portfolio.
Yeah. I think I'll clarify that. I mean, I introduced him as he's going for growth to leave it for his children, but he's actually wants 25% of the fund to pay off a mortgage. In a few years' time. So he's got that balance there of going to need some of the capital and the rest can be left to grow. So that's what you're referencing there.
Absolutely. So crystallise some of that maturity in the portfolio where he's made gains and put that into something that's going to give a much broader market correlation.
There are also some quite exciting things that you can do with funds. I know you mentioned passives, but you also recommended an active investment trust as well, didn't you? Yes.
Yes, and that investment trust was specifically selected with the idea of it being a relatively low cost and diversified.
It was Scottish Mortgage. Is that right?
It was Scottish Mortgage, which is one of the longest established investment trust, and that has a global index mandate. And again, that will depend on each individual client's expectations, and some people may not want to have such broad market exposure. They might prefer to have more of a regional conviction, so they might prefer to have something with more of a UK bias, for example, rather than the global index bias. But that is one investment trust that we feel offers very good value for money, especially for people who are very concerned about layers of fees on fees.
And there was a Helal, you sort of mentioned that he should be looking at funds, and your reason was the lack of emerging markets exposure. Can you explain that?
Yeah, so looking at the portfolio, his exposure to the UK is about 35%, US is about 43%, and then rest is in Europe. So he's really got nothing else in other regions. But what I would say about the portfolio and the types of stocks he has is, take for example Unilever and Reckitt Benckiser. Yes, they're listed over here in the UK, but these are companies that are pretty rapidly expanding into the emerging market. So we do have some emerging exposure there, but I would still say it's probably not enough. And I would say to get a good level of exposure to that sector. And the problem with the emerging markets is the fact that it takes a bit more knowledge of the region to actually know what you're buying into. So this is why I think a fund or an investment trust for those sorts of areas is a better route.
I mean, we don't want to detract from his shares only portfolio, but really he perhaps needs to swallow his aversion to funds a little and look at those. So thank you very much. Now, moving on, I'm going to look at this week's Big Theme article, in which we look at investing in Japan for income. Japan's economic recovery has been one of the most compelling stories in recent years. But with Japanese companies hugging profits to their chests, the region has been somewhat off limits to income investors. The corporate tide, though, may be turning. And Kate, you've been looking into this. How are things changing?
Well, and as you say, Japan just hasn't been a place for income investors for a long time. And that is because companies have tended to keep the capital on their balance sheets rather than paying it out to shareholders, either in the form of dividends or in share buybacks. But as the third arrow of Prime Minister Shinzo Abe's package of reforms, it's all aimed at corporate governance. And it's all about kind of boosting companies' return on equity and, you know, making them use that capital to kind of give it back to shareholders. So there's clearly a big kind of trend here. And that's culminated in a stewardship code, which launched this year. but also in the company, the pension fund, which is the world's biggest pension fund, has just changed its mandate and is now investing half in equities. So it's become an enormous shareholder in Japanese equities. So that's quite a lot of pressure on companies to start kind of giving back. So with all that in mind, Japanese fund managers are saying that actually things are changing and they're seeing dividends within their portfolios really growing, kind of double-digit increases in dividends. So the question is whether that's kind of dripping down into dividends coming off these funds. And that does seem to be the case. Things are increasing. Yields on these funds are increasing. I mean, this is not to say they're paying out amazing yields and you can get big income from Japan. That's not the case. But it's more a sense that things are slowly shifting. So now if you'd written Japan off because you just thought, you know, I can't get any income at all, that's no longer the case.
Halal, what's your view here? Do you think it's an area we should be looking at to sort of diversify one's income portfolio?
Yes, I agree. While at the moment, look at the Japanese index, you've got a dividend yield of about 2%. The UK index has a dividend yield of about 3.5%. So there's a big gap there. But I think if Japanese companies do change their strategy, become more shareholder friendly, we may see their dividend payout ratio, which is at the moment in the region of about 20 to 30%, rise up to more Western standards. You look at the FTSE 100, I think we're in the region of about 50 to 60% in terms of a payout ratio. So it's not a case of at the moment dividends are very good. It's just, I think, a case of going forward, the dividend payout ratios and therefore the income from stocks, stock investing in Japan is going to improve.
Do you think there's any risks that investors need to be aware of here with Japan? I mean, I don't see a lot of Japanese holdings in the reader portfolios, actually. I mean, maybe they're a bit worried about it.
Well, there's always the currency issues, obviously. Japan is one of those safe haven currencies and people do tend to flock to it every now and then and vice versa as well. So you will tend to see a bit of volatility here and there. But I think the Japanese economy, while it's improving in terms of growth, it still seems to be relatively slow going for the time being. But certainly, I think give it some years, and if we see some general stabilization in various parts of the world, especially, say, China, we may see more confidence in the Japanese stock market and things begin to look a bit more reassuring in Japan overall.
Delith, can I ask you? I mean, you're a funds selector, really. You're a fund expert. Are there any particular favourite Japan funds that you think we should be looking at here? What's your view?
I can certainly give some comment on those, but in some context, I have to say that we have a very low conviction for Japan on the basis of the equity risk premium that you get from the equity market in Japan. We consider other global markets offer much better values, so we have actually removed Japanese expressions from our client portfolios.
Oh, entirely gone. No
so
Japan
we,
at
we,
all.
We have had no Japan in our portfolios, which you know, Japan has and continues to be a challenging market in many ways with the currency challenges it presents as well. And it's a particularly difficult market for income-orientated investors. And I echo the comments about what the impact of the government pension scheme have had and the new JPX 400 index. And it's clear that many firms are seeking to be included in that index. And we've done some analysis, actually, looking at it's both the kind of the dividend factors of Japanese companies and also looking at how much they've spent on CapEx. So they're clearly, they are trying to change the metrics. We could see that in 2009, some research I've got in front of me that said they spent 7.4 times more on CapEx than they gave back to shareholders in 2009. But by last year, that had fallen to 5.3 times. But if you compare that to the US, it's more like 1-to-1. So they've still got quite a long way to go. More recent concerns we've seen, yes, we're encouraged by some signs of improvement, but weak exports, strengthening currency still make markets difficult. I've been a long time follower of Jupiter Japan Income Fund, Simon Somerville's fund. We like Simon. We like the process that the selectors there have had. But the income distribution from that fund is very low. It's sub 2% at the moment. Yeah. The other recommendation we probably suggest looking at, if you wish to allocate to Japan for income, would be the Moran Wright's Nippon Yield Fund. And that's not to be confused with the Moran Wright Fund that delisted after kind of virtually exploding in 2010. But, you know, I think that you've got to consider all of that in the context of the volatility of investing in Japan and the currency question, and whether you wish to take a hedged or a non-hedged expression into Japan. And I think those seasoned investors who've looked at the Japanese market over many years will find that they have made that call incorrectly many times through different market cycles. So, you know, Japan, not quite at your peril, but Japan with some caution is what I would suggest.
And I think the feature that we run in the magazine does have some options there for hedged and unhedged share classes of funds. That's right, Kate, isn't it?
It is, although actually a quick note on the hedging is that you can kind of protect your returns with hedging, but you can't actually protect dividends because dividends are too unpredictable for managers to, you know, to hedge. So if you do take a hedged share class, then your returns might not be eaten away by currency weakness, but your dividends would still be kind of damaged. So that's something to bear in mind.
Well, lots there to think about the Japan issue. Also in the magazine this week, we're looking at a number of investment trusts that were originally set up by wealthy families to manage their wealth. And in some cases, the family members are represented on the board and they're also major shareholders. The families may argue that because they're looking after their own interests as well as the other shareholders, that the interests there are aligned. But Delith, can I ask you what you think the benefits might be of investing in a family type investment trust? And are there any that you particularly like?
I mean, I perhaps might be giving you a contrarian view on that, because you can certainly point to some benefits of aligned interests, but they also give raise for concerns, and those concerns would be partly the free float that doesn't exist because they are so broadly held by families, and perhaps the tools that are available to them are slightly more limited, because as they come up to their maximum threshold of 50%, they're unable to perhaps use tools to kind of measure discount and premium like share buybacks. So I, for example, would point to if you looked at Caledonia, for example, where the family there owns 48.5% of the current issue, they have got very little leeway to be able to go and exercise some controls over discount and premium by share buybacks, which other trusts would not have the same restrictions on. Perhaps also some of these family trusts, which have got very long tenure and you know, they've been created to try and provide a total return delivery, almost a whole of wealth delivery. And the way that we look at constructing portfolios, we prefer to have high conviction in different regional markets than perhaps always allocating to a global total return strategy. So although I can make comments and we have a deep investment specialist within the team, they're not particularly instruments that I have hugely high conviction for versus other instruments available to us.
Halal, these family investment trusts are actually quite popular among Investors Chronicle readers. Things like Brit Capital and the Rothschild one, because they are into sort of wealth preservation. And if you feel that you want to, you're more of a cautious investor, that they can seem appealing. Would you agree with that strategy? Do you like that way of thinking about things?
In some ways, I agree for the reasons for investing in these types of investment trusts, because the controlling families are looking at wealth preservation. And if that's what you're after, your investment goals should, in theory, be in line with the investment trust. But I just think that there are a whole wealth of other instruments out there, and we shouldn't be so narrowly focused on just looking at these instruments for the sake of their particular characteristics.
Great. I mean, I think one of the advantages that we've cited in the article is that you know that they do select highly regarded managers to manage the money, and they, as a family, they keep a very close eye on the progress of the trust. So you've got sort of an extra element there.
I think we could keep pointing to, in some instances, there's a perception that some of the trusts are family trusts, and in fact, they are less controlled by the family now than they were in the past.
So they were originally set up by families, but now the shareholding is very, very small. I think Witan is one of those, isn't it? That was originally set up by the Henderson family, but now it's got a tiny percentage is owned by them.
These funds do have a very long track record. They have been around for a long, long time. So there is something going on, something right that's happening in terms of the way the funds are managed.
Great. Well, thank you very much for your input there. We'll talk about an issue which will be close to a lot of our listeners' hearts, which is pensions and the new pension freedoms, which were introduced in April. And since then, we've seen lots of platforms change their charging structures, including the charging structures on income drawdown. That's the mechanism by which you can draw money out of your pension in retirement post 55. Kate, you've been trying to make sense of the charge changes. What do you think investors need to be aware of?
I have been trying to make sense of it, and it is very confusing because there are so many different charges and they all kind of layer on top of each other. I think some of the key things to bear in mind are just the changes around some of these new options. So particularly flexible drawdown. A lot of platforms have cut fees in that area, so it's something to look at. In the past, most platforms would have charged, or a lot of them anyway, charged drawdown setup costs. So if you wanted to go into income drawdown, you would pay to set that up. And now quite a few platforms have scrapped that altogether. So AJ Bell, Your Investors, has cut that, Hargreaves. So it's something to look at, you know, will you still be paying setup costs? And then a lot of them have cut the annual fee that you pay to go into income drawdown as well. So that's also worth having a look at. And then I think the thing to bear in mind is that when you're looking at this kind of menu of fees now, there are legacy ones, you know, from the kind of old structure, and those will be layered on top of new fees for the new options. So uncrystallised lump sums. If you're just taking out lump sums, for example, that's different fees for if you want to go into drawdown. So I think really the thing to think about is which option are you going to use? And you need to make sure that that's the one you're looking at when you're looking at these platform charge fees.
It does all sound very, very confusing. And do you feel that the overall pitch is that investors are going to benefit from cheaper costs? So, I mean, we mentioned lots of charge cuts there, but are the platforms adding on fees in other areas that we're not aware of? I mean,
I don't get the sense they're adding fees, but I think there's definitely a sense that it's not going to be easy to make the most of the cost cuts potentially. I mean, particularly just because it's so hard to compare like with like here. I mean, even if one platform has cut costs somewhere, you'll still be paying its annual fee and then a platform fee maybe. So if you're trying to compare with another platform that hasn't cut the same cost, maybe that one would still be cheaper. You know, it's just very hard to compare. But there definitely have been quite a lot of fee cuts here. So overall, it will be a benefit to investors, but it'll take a lot of time for people to kind of work out what's right for them and where those cost cuts are.
So in this week's magazine, you've worked very hard to put together a large table where all the charges are detailed.
Yep, a lot of time spent in Excel. Yes.
and obviously, we're going to progress that and try and do some more analysis of what might be cheapest for different types of investors in future magazines. I mean, I think the issue here there is that really about the general benefits of keeping costs low for investors and how much investors should be focusing on charges. Because I know a lot of people will be focusing a lot on their actual investment performance and maybe not paying as much attention to charges as they should. Helal, I can see you nodding your head. How do you think investors should look at this sort of balance? And how often should you review charges on your portfolio, for example?
I think you should do it at least once a year. But looking at the our investor's portfolio, one thing I do credit him for is being not too active in buying and selling, because that will almost certainly eat away at the portfolio. And quite often, you can make some very bad decisions by being too active. So his buy and hold strategy, I think, for the longer term should be relatively good. But investment charges, don't just look at your dealing charges, also look at the admin charges that you're paying with your fund manager or broker. And also with funds, obviously, there's the annual management charge to consider. I certainly am a believer in exchange traded trackers, and where generally you've got relatively attractive admin charges.
I mean, there the products seem to be getting cheaper and cheaper, don't they, Dalith? Yes. It's quite extraordinary over the last year how cheap things are going.
It is exciting, although you rather wish that everybody would issue their best figures almost together, because it's the process of attrition by one basis point at a time that can be slightly frustrating. But the outcome, the end reduction in cost, is only to be welcomed. I just echo the focus on OCFs. I sit in as an advisor to a trust, and recently I was able to ask some questions on that about what were the ongoing charges for that particular mandate. And it's not every advisor has that information to their hand, and it's important. All investors should be able to challenge and ask, what is the cost of my investment on a look-through basis? So question what your advisor is charging you and what the underlying implementation costs are. We've done lots of analysis looking at the OCFs across active managed funds, and they've significantly come down post RDR in the market as a whole. So that is to be welcomed, and we continue to see price competition from the major providers.
Okay, well, I just for those who don't know, the OCF is the ongoing charges figure, and you can usually find that in the fact sheet of the fund or the investment trust, and it's definitely one to go and look at. So I think I want to thank our special guests for their sensible advice for investors on this show. So it's a thank you to Dalith Richards of Kleinwort Benson and Helal Mia of the Share Centre. And also thanks to my colleague Kate Bearley of Investors Chronicle. You can read more about Japan, family investment trusts and income drawdown charges in this week's issue of Investors Chronicle. Thank you for listening.